Citizens Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in North Central Indiana, right next to Terrapatani's Tavern, where the elite drink to eat, the mostly drink. Also nearby is Terrapatani's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar. Yep, the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, the insurgent, just plain old box holder. Good old Tommy O'Kay.
Well, we're back in the saddle again, boys and girls, here in the bunker here in North Central Indiana on a beautiful day here. Beautiful day. And we're at P.O. Box 401, as you already learned on the insurgent broadcast. We can't get rid of that insurgent thing. I think that's going to be with us for a while. Okay, let's see. What is it today? This is August the 31st. Whoa, the last day of August. You've only got a few hours to get her done. If you're bound to do it, you got to get her done in the next few hours. So I warned you. Otherwise, you're going to be spilled over into September, man. That September song. Well, I got to tell you a little story here that's a little off the political track, but there's maybe a little bit there, too. I watch the animals quite a bit. And the birds and everything, and I feed the birds, and I locate their feeder right outside my bedroom window so I can lay there and watch them. They're very interesting to watch. I watch how they feed each other and how they chase other birds off if they don't like them, and how sometimes an older one that looks pretty screwed up gets fed by the younger ones. But I've got an interloper. Yeah, I got a gopher. He's a cute little fella. But he can, it's hard to believe, but he's figured out he can jump from the house 6 foot to the feeder and then get inside the feeder and eat the bird seed. I'll tell you, I chased him off a few times, but and tried to make it harder for him to get in there, but he's such a game guy, I think I'm going to get him a special feeder, because he's a survivor. Well, yesterday I was looking out the window, and there he was up on top of the bird feeder, which is a cube of wires, and there's only about a 2-inch square or less that he can get into, and he can do it. He can squeeze his little body through there. Well, anyhow, he was laying on top there. I stepped out of the house onto the steps, and I was 3 feet from him, and I was talking to him. You know, only nuts like Terrible Tommy talks to the animals and hugs the trees. And there he was, just laying there, watching me, listening to me, and didn't make a move to run or escape. But if he needs to go, he can. He can jump out there about 6 or 8 feet and land on all fours, and he's gone. Fastest thing I ever seen. But it was amazing how he just laid there on top of that bird feeder and stared at me, and I stared at him, and I talked to him. He didn't say a damn word to me, independent cuss. But anyhow, I think I'm going to get him a special feeder for the gopher, because he's a survivor. He's a survivor. But anyhow, it's quite interesting to observe the actions of birds and small animals and see how they equate to human behavior. But one thing we learn is that the animals, their number one thing is to survive. It's built into them. It's hardwired into them to survive, and they will do whatever they have to do to survive. Well, I see one of my buddies sent me a note and said, yeah, Morris Dees is still alive. He's still walking around. He just gave a speech at the Jewish Federation of Greater Chattanooga. So that's interesting. But it's interesting that according to what I see, he didn't show up at the Julian Bond ceremony there at the Southern Poverty Law Center. I could be wrong. That could have political significance. But anyhow, he's not looking too good for wear, though, I'll tell you that. I'm much better looking at my age than he is, and we're only a couple of years separated in age. I forget whether he was older than me or I was older than him, but anyhow, yeah, well, you know, was he in the death pool? I forget. Probably not. Now, maybe he was. I don't know. I haven't heard any more about the death pool lately. I guess people didn't want to get into the death pool. I picked out mine. Old Morrissey's still fighting against survival speech, which he calls hate speech. Well, I hate the people who cause me to hate. That's the people I hate the most, and there's a hell of a lot of them. Well, the father of these two people that were gunned down by the nigger, mentally retarded nigger, has come out. I suppose you saw that. And his mission in his life is to shame pro-gun lawmakers. I mean, what a moron. He doesn't say anything about this black, mentally deficient nigger. In fact, he probably goes along with the reason the guy said he might have done it, because he'd been bugged on his job. Somebody called him a monkey man or something. Well, wow, man, I'm telling you. Too bad he's so stupid or cowardly not to blame the mental case nigger. I have no sympathy for these morons. Well, I see racism's alive and well down there in Shreveport, Louisiana. New York Times reveals that prosecutors in Shreveport, Louisiana exclude black citizens from serving on juries three times more often than jurors of other races, a trend that researchers say is indicative of what takes place in other jurisdictions. This trend toward all-white or nearly all-white juries means that the minority members of the population are left out. Well, that's too goddamn bad. Do you ever think there's a reason for not putting blacks on juries that are too stupid to tie their shoelaces? I mean, are they so screwed up on drugs they can't think? I believe that all blacks should be left off of all juries, because I'm beginning to revert back to my primordial base of not trying to empathize with anybody except the people who deserve to be empathized with. And that's why we're going to go more hardcore on this issue. If the police gun down the niggers, fine. When have you ever been able to talk to one of these black activists in an intelligent way? When have you been invited on TV or radio to talk about racial separation? When? So I think that Tommy's been too soft for a while. We're going to have to get back on the hardcore situation. We can't empathize with these people. We can't say, all those bad cops because they're serving a purpose. They may be sometimes bad cops, but sometimes bad cops do good things. I think we should let it all hang out now. We got nothing left to lose. Shoot 'em up, cops. Kill those bastards. And all you people out there thinking Trump's going to do anything about anything are fools to be not dealt with, because they just don't understand how billionaires think, how race traders think. So from now on, we have to get back to the original position that anything that bad that happens to primarily Negroes, niggers, moon crickets, or whatever, is good. anything that happens to white racialists is bad. Anything that happens to white race mixers is doubly good. And it's a waste of time to talk to them. To attempt to talk to these people, you're wasting your time. I've been wasting a lot of time. I'm not going to pay attention to the news much anymore because it's so ridiculous. It's almost an insult to your intelligence to watch the news or listen to the news. So I've made my day a lot easier now. I just immediately go through and erase everything that's nonsense. And I'm not going to sit there and watch this stupid stuff, even from Russia Today. They've all gone over the fence. Russia Today is crying about niggers in America got such a bad rap. But I remember when blacks tried to enroll at Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow and they got the shit beat out of them. What about that, Mr. Putin? Yeah. They're all worried about what's happening, all this gun use everywhere. It's terrible. We got to do something about it. But they don't talk about nigger control or mestizo control. It's only controlling where the guns are. Well, anyhow, they're always comparing this gun situation statistics to foreign countries. Of course, hell of a lot of foreign countries have got a very high murder rate, but they don't consider machetes a gun. I'm more of a position, you can take my gun, but don't take my machete. I'll defend it with my life. You see, hundreds and hundreds of people being murdered in the most savage way in these third world countries, but if they say they're not killed by guns, or most of them are not killed by guns, but machetes, that don't count. They're not going to register their machetes. Well, I think I'd be more inclined to go along with giving up my guns than giving up my machete and my pitchfork. And when it comes to the last, my golf club. I got a golf club sitting on the front steps. You ever been hit in the head with a golf club? It's probably a lot better than being shot. No, it'll be much worse than being shot in some places. But you know what they never do? It's very simple. Compare the statistics of gun violence in 1945 or 50 to what gun violence is today. And even compare gun violence to the days of segregation in the South and see what the figures are. So it's obviously got something to do with the people, not the gun. Call in his radio shows and says, what was the gun violence level statistics in 1949 in Mississippi, Alabama, or even Ohio or Indiana? Oh, well, we can't do that. Well, how come you're comparing it to overseas someplace? Incidentally, gun violence is on the rise in England, France, and all those places. So trying to get around it that way isn't going to work either. But I think we're best off supporting all the gun legislation. Let them start taking the guns away. It's okay. You know that certain people are always going to have guns. And you're probably in more danger by all these stupid white people and religious fanatics around you with guns anyhow. Crap hits the fan, I'm more concerned about these Christian fanatics that claim they're so peaceful and love the baby Jesus. Because when they go crazy, they do like they did in the witch hunts and all that kind of stuff. They're very dangerous people. I know when you try to argue or debate with them, they end up saying, you're going to hell, and I hope you burn forever, and I hope your whole family burns in hell forever because you don't love the baby Jesus. You know, over in Israel, there's some people that are doing the right thing. There's a lot of non-Christian, non-Jewish people in Israel. They're secular. A lot of the scientists. And they're proving month after month about the stuff that's untrue in the Bible. Doing great research. I just downloaded a long research on the escape from Egypt and how it never happened. And there never could have been that many Jews in Egypt. And when the Pharaohs wrote about all this stuff, they didn't write anything about that because it didn't happen. The Exodus did not happen. You never see Christian apologists coming up with that stuff. Because they say anything in that Bible's got to be goddamn true. And if you don't think so, I'll slit your throat. Yeah. So we have Jews researching and coming up with more truth about the bullshit in the Bible than anybody connected with Christianity. They don't want to do it. Now, if you go on the internet and dig around, you'll find Jewish scientists in Israel that have disproven a whole bunch of stuff in the Old Testament. It's there. But people on the right wing are not going to say, well, yeah, but that's a Jew. He couldn't tell the truth. Well, I don't think the Christian Zionists could tell the truth any better. In fact, they don't tell the truth at all. They're still teaching their kids that fish swallow people. And people walk on water and people rise from the dead. Now, if you can teach that to somebody, boy, you're a good teacher. Okay. Man rose from the dead. He'd been in the grave for days and the maggots were eating him up. And he rose right up and walked away a healthy man. How are you going to talk to people that believe shit like that? You can't talk to them. So I guess you'll have to get most of your anti-biblical stuff from Israel. Yeah. Okay, I covered the fact that they don't check statistics from, say, 49 or 38 or anything like that. Oh, they need to check before the war, because my position is we've been at some kind of war ever since 41. What do you think they were doing? They were training soldiers to kill people. Guys that had never had a gun all of a sudden were familiar with guns. And so I'm sure that after 45, the gun crimes went up quite a bit, but nothing like it is today. But when your government trains you to be a killer, which they do, I know they did me, and then they put guns in your hands, and if you see any active duty, even more prone to be involved in something with PTS or something. And I heard a guy call in on the radio last night. He said, look, I had PTSD, and when I come back from the Middle East, he said, I didn't have a gun. But if I had a gun, I'm sure I would have killed somebody. Because he walked down the street and he just dared anybody to give him any trouble. So that's what that does. And then, millions of people are over-the-counter drug addicts. And a lot of these young guys that have been killers are on the drugs. Legal drugs. Not so much illegal drugs, legal drugs. Well, let's talk about another reason for more killing. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we see it in the movies, on television, in the books, in the comic books, everywhere. People killing people in the most wild and woolly ways. You don't think that has something to do with it? Now, neither the drug business or the Hollywood people will not admit this. I remember we went through this about 10 years ago, big deal about these violent games that kids are sitting there playing hours and hours at a time. You don't think that could cause people to, some people, to get a hold of a gun and kill somebody? Who's kidding who? And of course, the other thing is the coddling of Negroes. Treating them like some kind of special item. Putting them in the movies like they're geniuses. They're presidents, they're generals, they're this, they're that. They can do anything. You don't think that has something to do when the blacks can't hit the ball? When they can't make the grade and they've been told they should be a nuclear scientist? Oh, you don't think that caused violence? You don't have to be a college professor to understand basics. And now the system has taught white people to worship Negroes. To worship them. That's what they're doing. They're making icons out of these subhumans. And they expect nothing to happen. You know, big apes come up to a beautiful white girl on the campus of a college, and of course she says if she don't want to mess around with him, he's going to say, "You're a racist bitch." "Oh no, I'm not. I'll go with you." Yeah. So we got to lose all this empathy, any empathy we might have had. We have to go strictly might is right. I played around with that. Let's just talk together. Maybe we can figure it out. Maybe we can have peaceful separation. Bullshit, it ain't going to happen. It's not going to happen. And most of that stuff coming from the media in Hollywood, well, the TV screen is a hypnotic device. The movie theater, the whole thing's a hypnotic device. It's, if you want to read it right out of the hypnosis manuals, you can. Experts know all this, but it makes too much money. Billions of dollars are being made by worshiping the Negro and by putting out super violent movies, putting out super dangerous drugs and alcohol. And then they say, "I wonder why people go off the deep end. Wonder why." And then once you've got them primed, all you have to do is say, "You're being discriminated against. Those evil white guys are discriminating against you." Yeah, that's all you have to do, and there they go. But there's not going to be any coexistence with the black race. Especially not with the mulattoes, because they're the most dangerous. It's just not going to happen. And if they keep trying, we know it's going to fail. And it'll just mean more of the turd world here in this country. So you got to get hard-nosed. You got to limit your circle of friends, because most of them are just associates. They can't be trusted. Think all wrong on most issues, even in many times your own family, and you could keep wasting time with them. Quit wasting your time, racist. Be a white racist. It don't make any difference how many friends you got, because you only have associates. A friend is someone who'll take a bullet for you. So how many friends do you have? I'm just thrilled that I've always been a lone wolf, socially. I've always been a lone wolf. I can stand a few minutes or maybe a few hours with the crowd. But beyond that, forget it. I got to get out of there. Most young white boys are convinced they got to have white buddies. Whatever they do, they got to have white buddies. and the worst is organized sports. Yeah, football, basketball, and all that, where most of the time the guys get together and leave their wives and family at home. And usually it ends up with a broken family. Wives get tired of that shit. Or they pretend to become one of these sports addicts themselves. I see them all around here wearing all this bullshit sports hats, sports shirts, sport pants, probably sports underwear. And they go crazy. They got sports flags on their car. Yeah. They go through town in a parade. Yay, yay for my team. What a miserable waste of Aryan flesh. But that starts off in grade school and high school, training them. And then, of course, once you're integrated, you got all the niggers in the school. You got to learn to get along because it's our team against their team. We got good niggers on our team. They got bad niggers on theirs. Don't even think about saying something disparaging about niggers. Oh, gee, kid says something like that. Even a very minor statement, you know. Like, that nigger stinks. Well, you're out of there, boy. You're off the team. You're not loving the niggers enough. You're not worshiping the nigger sports people enough. You're not letting your daughters go out with the nigger football players. You're out of here. And here's an example of what happens when these kids go to school. And what they get beat into their heads every day about equality and all that stuff. Across the road from me is a nice family, businessman, all that kind of stuff. And I get along with them quite well, but I've noticed something over the years since I've been here, that their little boy, when I first moved in here, he waved all the time when he saw me, and I waved back and talked to him once in a while, and he rode his little three-wheeler around in the field across the street, and he was always real friendly. And all of a sudden, he started changing. And it was about the time that he was getting out of grade school and going into high school or junior high. And I watched the kid, and he's gotten more unfriendly over the years as he grows older. Now, there's only one thing that could be. Now, his parents are nice people. We get along fine. And I'm sure the dad's not super race mixer. Him and his wife ride Harleys and so forth, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. But he's getting it in school. This kid's getting it in school. To the point, well, you don't even say hello, don't wave or anything. So that's what they're doing to these kids. And the parents are too cowardly to straighten them up and train them right. When they come home from school, say, what'd you learn today? Well, I learned niggers were wonderful. Niggers created the pyramids and niggers did all this stuff. Son, daughter, let's sit down here at the table and look at the facts of the case. Look at history the way it really was. But they don't do that because they don't want to be looked down upon by their own kids. Well, the school told us this, so it's got to be true. So millions of white kids don't have a chance. They're trained to be race mixers and trained to be, I'm okay, you're okay. Trained to be all these things that the system wants them to be. The system. That's right. But I'm pretty sure most of the people to tune into this radio club know these things probably without me telling you. You probably, if you're old enough, you might have known them before I did. It took me a long time. But I think in reality, we ought to be a little bit more like J.B. Stoner and less like David Duke. In fact, I think we should be a lot more like J.B. Stoner and a lot less like David Duke. Now, I've talked to you about the brainwashing using television, the movies, Hollywood, ads on TV, football games, you name it, churches, everything, that you're hypnotized, mesmerized, and you're a victim and you don't even know it. You can go back to the 60s when Vance Packard wrote the first book on the subject, or probably the first book on the subject, The Hidden Persuaders. And he exposed the whole thing coming out of Wall Street and Madison Avenue. But it goes back to the, I'm trying to remember his name, I've told you, the guy that convinced all the suffragettes marching for their rights to have a cigarette, pushing the women to start smoking, to show your freedom, to show your independence. The same man was the man who got the country going towards getting into World War I. People weren't interested in getting into the war. It was, most of the people were anti-war at that time. But this guy went around with his special crew of indoctrinators from town to town to town, pushing for the war. Pretty soon, all then they needed to do was have a... Yeah, his name was Bernays. Yeah, Bernays. He did more to screw this country up than almost anybody outside the churches. I think even the Christian Bible talks about people who are... A people who are lost because they don't have the right kind of leaders. They don't have leaders. They've always had plenty of leaders. That's the problem. We don't have enough people who think independently. Independent thinkers. Lone wolves that don't listen and believe everything they hear. That's what we have a lack of. Shit, we got leaders up the butt. Everywhere you look, there's a leader leading us off into different wrong directions. That's the way that works. Anyhow, as I said, the theater screen, the television screen, all of those kind of things are hypnotic devices. And most people walking around are in a somnambulistic state all the time. That's why somebody can go out on a Sunday afternoon with no thought of buying something and come back with a $20,000, $30,000 car. They're on the verge of hypnotic suggestion all the time. And so they sort of listen to the last person who lied to them. So for the rest of the show, I'm going to read you from my hypnosis handbooks. I took classes in hypnosis years ago. Yeah, I used to take classes up in L.A. I learned quite a bit. I didn't stick through the whole course, but I learned enough to know what they were doing to us and how they were doing it. So let me read to you out of one of my textbooks. The Characteristics of Physical and Emotional Suggestibility. Oh, no wonder I couldn't see. I had the wrong glasses on. Yeah, hold on a second here. Hidden deep in the mind of every hypnotist is a nagging question that comes up every time a subject does not respond as hypnotist expects or desires. This question has been rationalized, analyzed, and lied about, but still remains. Why do some subjects respond to hypnotic suggestion and depth while others do not? That may be the answer of the lone wolf. The answer was discovered just a decade ago. Now, since I used these books back in the 60s, maybe the early 70s, that gives you an idea. For many generations, hypnotists have divided suggestibility into three different stages: hypnoidal, light, cataleptic, medium, and somnambulistic, deep. They believed that the deeper the subject, the better the results the hypnotist could obtain. A cataleptic subject would achieve better results than a hypnoidal subject, and a somnambulistic subject would do best of all. the 60% or 70% of the population that fell into the category of suggestibility that they believed to be lighter than hypnoidal was dismissed as being unhypnotizable. Since 1967, when the Hypnosis Motivation Institute recognized the existence of two distinct types of suggestibility, physical and emotional, a new hypnotic world has been revealed. Human behavior has led us to recognize that everyone is suggestible to something, some to physical sensations, others to emotional stimuli, still others to environmental stimuli, and some to all three. This new information has opened doors to the hypnotherapist, the motivator, the counselor, the system, and to anyone using hypnosis for self-improvement, or maybe not self-improvement, because they proved over and over again that the military had programs where they could hypnotize someone to do something that they wouldn't normally do. You're sold the false information that you can't be hypnotized if you don't want to. Well, that's not true. You can be. The military and CIA used hypnotism to get people to become Manchurian candidates. That's why that movie didn't come out for years. Frank Sinatra kept it out of the media. And I think he was influenced by his pro-military-industrial complex attitude. The line with its upper end at 100 and lower end at 0 represents the 100% physical suggestibility subject. He will respond to any direct, literal suggestion affecting his body, but will not respond to suggestions affecting his emotional behavior. They're showing a graph here. That's what I'm talking about. The line with its upper end at 0 and lower end at 100 represents the 100% emotionally suggestible subject. He will respond to all suggestions affecting his emotional behavior, but will not respond to suggestions affecting his physical body or physical movements. This type of subject does not respond well to direct, literal suggestions, but is very responsive to inferred suggestions and misdirection. That's a very important line there, inferred suggestions. A line drawn between the two 50s, dotted line on the diagram, represents the 50-50 subject, 50% emotional and 50% physical. Hold it. Don't go away. This type of subject has traditionally been called a somnambulist. He's the best subject for stage hypnosis because he responds to physical challenges, emotional suggestions, positive and negative hallucinations, amnesia, anesthesia, and time distortion. There are relatively few people with this type of suggestibility. Although it can be developed over a period of time, it is not necessary for good results in hypnotherapy. Not all subjects fall into the extreme emotional and physical categories. There are subjects with every possible combination of physical and emotional suggestibility, from 1% emotional and 99% physical to vice versa. To see a dramatic representation of any combination, locate the known score, either physical or emotional, on the suggestibility scale. Connect that point with the point where the triangles touch, and extend the resulting line to reach the line of opposite suggestibility. The individual's full suggestibility is now graphically demonstrated. For example, the starred line on the suggestibility scale represents a 75% physical, 25% emotional subject. In addition to physical and emotional suggestibility, there is a subcategory of emotional suggestibility called intellectual suggestibility, which is present in only 5% of the population. The intellectually suggestible person is one who must have a reason for everything. If you tell him that when you hypnotize him, he will feel calm and relaxed, he will ask you why. That's me. When you give him suggestions in hypnosis, he will ask why they will work. You can usually reach him only through inferred suggestions and must always give him reason for the suggestion and a reason why it will work. The auto-dual method of hypnosis is the most successful with a subject of this type. If you tell him to repeat everything after you and assure him that he is really conducting the session himself, he will usually respond more rapidly than if you intellectualize every statement you make to him. In the past, only physical suggestibility was recognized. Consequently, it was believed that the depths attained in hypnosis by a physical suggestible subject were the only true indicators of the hypnotic state, and that the methods used to hypnotize a subject were the same for everyone. In addition, 60% to 70% of the population was considered unhypnotizable. We now know that these unresponsive subjects were emotionally suggestible, and that hypnoidal, cataleptic, and somnambulistic stages of hypnosis for emotionally suggestible students or subjects are quite different than those who are physically suggestible. The emotional somnambulist, 100% emotional, responds with the same intensity to suggestions affecting his emotional behavior as the physical somnambulist, 100% physical, responds to suggestions related to his physical body, but his reactions are not as immediately obvious. The emotional somnambulist appears to be in a very light state of hypnosis, or not to be in a hypnotic state at all, while the physical somnambulist exhibits all the characteristics formerly attributed to the somnambulistic state. One thing to remember, hypnotism and mesmerism are two different things. They have similarities, but the larger groups of people are more influenced by mesmerism. And you can look that up in a dictionary. In fact, natural somnambulists, most of these big leaders that become so powerful, like Hitler, Mussolini, Churchill, all these guys, they're working with mesmerism, not hypnosis. They may use symbols as a hypnosis situation, like the swastika and so forth, or the American flag or whatever, or the stars and bars. In fact, natural somnambulists, 50% physical and 50% emotional, were not even distinguished from physical somnambulists in the past because both have the same appearance in the hypnotic state. The difference between them, however, is vast because the natural somnambulist will respond equally to suggestions affecting his emotions and his physical body and not just to one extreme. I got interrupted two or three times in this show, and one, my man that mows the yard with his big tractor ran his tractor and almost turned it over. I had to go out and pull him out of the ditch. Anyhow, that's the way it goes, so if you hear anything that's disjointed, well, you'll know why. And let's see, where am I at here? I know I marked my place in this book. I know I did. Let me see here. Anyhow, one thing also you'll notice, if I didn't make it clear, all your politicians that are successful are using a form of mesmerism. Not so much hypnosis. Mesmerism is a lot faster, and it works quite well. Now, also, you can read another book. Did I tell you the title of this book? Professional Hypnotism Manual. You can probably get it, and it's by Kappas, K-A-P-P-A-S. He ran some hypnosis classes for a few years up in L.A. Also, there's a book called The Crowd Psychology, by Gus David LeBone. You need to read that. If you're not going to read anything, read that. Crowd Psychology by Gus David LeBone. French, I believe. and you learn almost everything you ever want to know about human nature and how to handle it. So anyhow, like I say, now Trump is a perfect mesmerist. He is, due to his audacity and mesmerism, he's really got him in the palm of his hand. But all the successful politicians do. And you can tell the ones that are not because they're at the bottom of the list. Some of them only run about 2 points, 3 points, 4 points. But all your really good ones stack up a lot of support fast. And you thought it was all accidental. Silly boy. It's everywhere. Every ad, every video you see, it's everywhere. And the sheep don't realize it, and really, they don't care. Okay, here we go. The understanding of emotional suggestibility has expanded the scope of hypnosis by taking it out of the guessing stage and allowing us to work with a great many people with whom we could not work before. Emotional suggestibility was discovered through accident, determination, and ego. In trying to prove to ourselves that the individual could be hypnotized, we discovered how to develop and use inferred inductions and methods of misdirection that were effective with certain types of subjects who were not responding to the usual methods. The question often asked by hypnosis is, why does a subject enter hypnosis very quickly and deeply one day and only very lightly the next? Incidentally, in these classes, several times they tried to hypnotize me. They never could hypnotize me. I don't know what that tells me. Does that mean I'm stupid? I wanted to be hypnotized, but I couldn't be hypnotized. We now know that the answer is that one day the operator happens to use inferred suggestions for the entire induction, and the next day uses literal suggestions. He probably achieved success with inferred suggestions by accident because he at least partially recognized that the subject was not responding well to his customary literal suggestions. When he finally began to correlate with suggestions were affecting which subjects and why, success became more frequent and more enduring. Once we recognize emotional suggestibility and learn how to hypnotize this type of subject, we found that he is far more receptive to therapy than the physical subject, who responds well to physical tests and on the surface appears to be a better subject. The reason for this is that therapy usually does not deal with physical problems. In most cases, it deals with emotional problems or with physical problems which have been created by emotional problems. In which case the emotional problem is cause and the physical manifestation becomes the symptom. In therapy, you must create emotional suggestion, if it is not already present, in order to affect emotional problems the client may be having. Unfortunately, most modern-day hypnotists are totally unaware of the existence of emotional suggestibility and are therefore unable to help people who are the most receptive to hypnotherapy. In essence, suggestibility is a person's hypnotic personality, determined by all the conditioning and all the experiences he has had through his life, particularly the experience of the first 6 to 8 years of life. A person becomes suggestible to one extreme or another because of a defense against either the emotional or the physical. He develops his defense to protect himself from rejection of either his physical or his emotional side, whichever is more vulnerable. The suggestible pattern of an emotional is based on a defense to protect his physical body. He will put his emotions out first before he will accept physical touch. In other words, when he is faced with uncomfortable physical contact, attention, or pain, or if he senses he is about to be put into such a position, he responds with emotions of embarrassment, fear, anger, apprehension, emotional irritation, or frustration as a line of defense to protect his physical body from discomfort. And that's basically where you find the fight or flight syndrome. He's either going to run or he's going to pull a gun. He is especially susceptible to this threat because he tends to be overly concerned with what others think about him, and his embarrassment level related to his physical body is easily reached. Only if the threat turns out to be unfounded or non-existent, he finds that he can accept positive emotional feelings, will the defense mechanism lessen his capacity for physical acceptance increase? That reminds me of a bathroom in a bar or a restaurant. I've noticed this a lot. Guys go in a bathroom and they have a penis problem. They want to hide their penis. They don't want to have in any way anybody see their penis. So they have these crazy little urinals that pretty much cover you around the sides. Now, a perfect example of what I'm talking about is a place I go once in a while, and they have a stool and they have a urinal. And when I go in there, sometimes there's a line of guys, and there's only one in there urinating. And I say to him, "What the hell are you standing out here for? It's a two-holer." You know, two-holer from back in the day when we had two-holer outhouses. And they looked sort of embarrassed. I said, "Well, come on in here, for Christ's sake. I'm not going to look at your pee-pee." But the average guy will stand out there for 5 minutes waiting to get one of these, either the stool or the urinal, all to himself with nobody in there. So there's a real psychological problem among men. I notice it, I don't know. I don't see the black guys, but white men sure have that problem. Strange. The physical, unlike the emotional, uses his physical body as a defense to protect his emotions. Of course, talking about that urinal, in Europe, where you just line up and there's a trench running down the floor, you have no boards on either side of you, nothing to obstruct people's view of you, and guys seem to handle that fine. Seems like only in the United States, maybe in England, do we have this pee-pee fetish problem. The physical, unlike the emotional, uses his physical body as a defense to protect his emotions. He will respond to physical touch with pleasure and has great need for it, as it represents acceptance to him. He expresses himself literally and bluntly and is not overly concerned with how others see him. When he becomes involved with explaining something, he tends to be animated in movement and gestures, and to move close to the person he is talking to. He will usually dominate the conversation, barely listening to what the other person has to say. He may cut someone off in the middle of a sentence in order to get his point across. Whether he recognizes it or not, he has difficulty understanding the emotions of others because he can relate only to what he feels and not to what others say or feel. And that's true mostly of politicians. They don't really give a shit about what you think at all. They're good at pretending. You get in a line to shake the hand of a politician, the best politicians are the ones that sound like they really give a shit. And those are the ones that don't give a shit about anything but themselves. Because he relates to physical communication, he attempts to reach others through physical closeness and body language, and suppresses his ability to relate verbally on more than a surface conversational level. Only when he has achieved enough physical acceptance to ease his urgency and make him feel comfortable can he open up to positive emotional communication. I made a note here years ago in this book, Breakdown of Types. The physical speaks inferentially and understands literally. The emotional speaks literally and understands inferentially. Even though it's emotional, the emotional wants to sit back and listen and prefers not to put himself in an embarrassing situation or fight for a chance to speak. And even though the physical prefers to carry the conversation, a communications barrier will arise between the two opposites. The emotional will begin to feel frustrated because his suggestibility will not allow him to speak with ease until he is comfortable emotionally. And the physical contact needs to prevent the emotional from being at ease. The emotional will also feel that the physical is not truly understanding him. You ever have talked to somebody like that? You can't get a word in edgewise. In such a situation, I know a woman like that. In such a situation, the emotional will tend to close off and withdraw into itself. When deprived of closeness and contact, the physical will become even more aggressive in order to obtain the physical acceptance he needs to protect himself against emotional rejection. In other words, he has to get louder and louder and more forceful for the other person to understand him or see him or accept him. This breakdown of communication due to differences in suggestibility is the basis of many friendship, family, and relation problems. Well, that's about it for now. I know that's sounds a little complicated, but I think you get the general idea of why some people make great salesmen and other people can't sell anything. I remember when I was in business in California, and I read a book called The Art of Salesmanship or something like that. No, what was it? Wait a minute. The Art of Closing Sales. I'm going to tell you, that's the only book you'll ever need to read on sales. It's absolutely the only one you'll need. And it taught you in there to start closing a sale the minute you start talking to someone. You're already trying to close a sale. One of the pitches I had to sell a new TV out of my store was, I'd be talking to the people and I'd say, is that your car out there, or your van, or your truck? Yeah. I wonder if this TV will fit in the back. Should we check? And we'd go out and look and say, hey, it'll fit in there, and I'd close the deal every time, or almost every time. So you got to get them hooked that way. And that's the way politicians and teachers and preachers, and they all work. You got to get them the hook. And if you ever want to sell something, you immediately start to close before you even really get started. You don't wait for an hour, half an hour, and lose the sale. Because if you talk to a customer for half an hour, you've lost the sale in most cases. So remember, this book and then The Crowd Psychology, by Gus Abe Lavone. These two books will help you through a lot of problems. And you need this guy, instead of going out and buying guns like a lot of the right-wing idiots do. Yeah, I saw the problem. I'll just buy a gun, which the gun may never be fired. I've got two or three guns in my closet here that have never been fired. I haven't fired them since I got them. I feel like I probably ought to sell two or three, because unless there's a revolution starts tomorrow, I'll never use them before I croak. But to survive, you need to understand a lot of things, and one of the things that most people leave out is psychological, reading people, knowing people, see through these guys, these informants. I could save guys all the time from being trapped into an informant situation if they'd listen to me. Dennis Mahan never listened to me. He said, yeah, 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 but he didn't listen to me. And I know several guys doing hard time that didn't listen to me. I'm not trying to say I'm brilliant, but I do know how to read people and how they play you and how they learn how to do it. They learn how to mesmerize you and all that kind of stuff. I'll be back tomorrow on Tears Day. Terrible Tommy, off and clear, and, well, I don't know what to say, but watch out, take care of your own situation, be a lone wolf. You don't have to have a lot of people around you, you don't have to go to big meetings, you don't have to join groups. In fact, that's the worst thing to do right now. Sayonara. Wait a minute. You know, I switched mics, and I think this mic is not putting out as much as my other mic. I may switch back. This is a Bluetooth, or Blue something. And the other one was had more output, so what do you think?